Back to our regular shiur. Before we do so, yes, somebody made a comment that my suit is dirty. You are correct. The Gemara does say that a Talmud Chacham is not allowed to walk around with dirty clothing, and I have to agree that I appreciate that sentiment, and you're not allowed to walk around in such a way. When you have a position, you should live up to that position and be presentable. My father always comments that it bothers him when he goes to a wedding and they call up some rabbi onto the chuppah and he comes and his shoes aren't polished and his suit is all dirty, and he says it just bothers him, which I appreciate that it bothers my father. So yes, my suit is dirty, but I couldn't be prouder as to why my suit is full of paint. The reason why is because we have one of the very great Nashim Sidkanios is actually sitting here. I'm not going to embarrass her, other than the fact that I'm going to say her name is Sherry Hammer. And she gave me the amazing opportunity last night to join her at an iShine event. If you don't know what iShine is, you should find out. If you've never been there, you should go. I know we're not all invited to go, but we should make an effort to try and give of our time. This was such a meaningful evening and experience that I was so privileged to be a part of. Spending my night with 55 children who need help, who need intervention, either because they don't have parents. 25 of them do not have parents. They're Yisomim. They all live in our neighborhood. They're not from other places. They're all from here. 25 of these young kids, age 5 to 12, do not have parents. And the rest of them all have family members who are undergoing some kind of treatment, and their parents are busy taking care of them in and out of the hospitals and are unable to do homework with them. And watching how the high school students of our community invest of their time as volunteers to pick up these kids from school, to bring them to the location where they have this program, to serve them dinner, to do homework with them, and then paint menorahs with paint that doesn't come out of your clothing. So it happens to be that I was not told beforehand that I was going to ruin my clothing, but I said I couldn't be prouder than to ruin my suit than for that. I feel this is a badge of honor, so I said I didn't want to not wear it today. In your honor, I'm wearing it, and then I will throw it out, or I'll keep it for the next time I go to iShine. And I have to say that it was just so special, and I don't know why this is the best kept secret in the five towns, but it's something all of us should know about. It's something all of us should take part in because it's so special. And I told Sherry yesterday, you know, there are a million and one ways that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can describe himself. There are so many things that the Ribono Shel Olam does on a daily basis. And yet, when the Pasuk describes what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is about, it says that he's the Avi Yisomim V'dayin Ha'almanos, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't think that it's beneath him to take care of a Yasom who needs help. And he doesn't think that it's beneath him to be the one to defend the Almana who is sometimes taken advantage of. And for me to be there, and people were saying, oh, the rabbi's getting down on his hands and knees and coloring with the kids. I don't think there could be a greater privilege than for a person to get their hands dirty and to get down on your hands and knees and do things like that. And I really thank you for giving me that opportunity. I would encourage, as I mentioned, everybody here to share in this wonderful experience. It was something that was profoundly impactful on me, and I'm sure that it will be on anyone else who would take advantage of such an experience as well. So, the last 2 weeks, we spoke about something that, if it were up to me, I would talk about for the rest of the year. There is so much to speak about in this regard. I know that nobody else is interested in this topic as much as I am, but it's something that is of great interest to me, only because I'm confronted with it all the time by members of our community. As we know, the last 2 weeks we spoke about the struggle of infertility, and we had a little bit of a hashkafa shiur 2 weeks ago, Yaakov, Rachel, Leah, the whole story there. I wanted to just talk about something in this regard, and then I promise next week we won't continue. I think that this is just a very interesting part of the discussion, and again, there are volumes and volumes about every little detail and aspect and variation of potential treatments and different things and what the halacha says about it and what not, what's acceptable and what is not, and all the different opinions. There's so much to know and there's so much to delve into, but this is really something just on a general level that I think there's not a lot spoken about, but it's something that really needs to have attention given to it. And the reason why I want that everybody should just be aware of this is because I actually checked this morning to see what is the percentage of women who are of childbearing age who are going through some kind of struggle with infertility. So I looked this morning, the CDC on their website, whether you trust the CDC or not is your own problem, but I will tell you that the CDC website wrote that in 2019, the numbers are as follows. 10% of all women of childbearing age, which means between 15 and 44, 15 is a bit young, but between 15 and 44, 10% of those women in the United States have difficulty getting or staying pregnant. That's 6.5 million women between the ages of 15 and 44 who have trouble either getting pregnant or staying pregnant. I know somebody who currently just experienced their 8th miscarriage in the last 3.5 years. Unexplained. They can't figure out why it is. They've been to every expert in the country. Nobody has any reason why this is happening. For some reason, after 5 or 6 weeks, or sometimes 7 or 8, the pregnancy is terminated, and the doctors cannot figure out what's happening. That's one example of something that a person in our community is going through. People may not be aware of it. I'm sure they aren't, actually. But it's something that many, many, many women struggle with. And there are different ways of dealing with these problems. Okay, there are different ways of dealing with this. Some of them are very basic and minimal intervention that really don't require such experts. An OBGYN can help out, an endocrinologist is able to help out, and they give some kind of estrogen modulator, they give some kind of treatment that's really not anything too invasive. It's a minimal, a basic intervention. I don't mean to downplay that people have to go through this and take pills, but on the grand scheme of interventions, it's not the greatest intervention. Hormone regulators, sometimes diabetic medications, different things that are given. But those are all medications. It's not so difficult. There are other times, unfortunately, when some of these situations require a far more invasive intervention, and it's a much more intensive reproductive technology that's required in order to help this person. So if somebody needs an egg retrieval, an IVF, an IUI, surrogacy, the list goes on and on. There's so much to talk about, but these are far more intensive, far more invasive procedures. And the question that really I want to talk about in today's discussion is, how does the halacha classify, how does the halacha categorize a couple who is going through the struggle of infertility? So you'll say, why is it the halacha's business? What does that mean? And the reason why it's important to know their halachic status is because when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos, there are so many questions that potentially come up that couples are often faced with, and it's very hard to know what would we give an allowance for and what perhaps not. Where would they be allowed to break one of the laws of Shabbos, and where perhaps would we say it would be inappropriate? Oftentimes, there are specific times of the month, there are specific days in the month, specific opportunities that present themselves for a particular treatment or an intervention that cannot be delayed a day and cannot be postponed or pushed up earlier. It's very specific to the body regulation as to when the man or the woman has the opportunity to go ahead with this kind of treatment. And if you're going to say that today is Shabbos and therefore you're not able to take advantage of whatever is being offered, that is something that is a very serious question. Just to scratch the surface to understand like some of the questions that come up, the most basic question is taking a medication on Shabbos. Sometimes the medication is in the form of a pill, which is a shaila in and of itself. Sometimes the medication is in the form of an injection, which is also a shaila. When you take an injection, sometimes it bleeds, sometimes it doesn't. Do we know in advance if it's going to bleed? Do we know in advance that it's not going to bleed? That is obviously something that one needs to think about. Sometimes there's an injection that's taken to enhance ovulation. And obviously that's something that a woman might need in this kind of situation, or a woman might have to take a blood test, a man might have to take a blood test. There's potential malacha involved whenever you do that. It's called chavala. You're not allowed to draw blood, which is relevant. The Gemara in Ksubas actually talks about popping a pimple. I know nobody likes to talk about that, but every once in a while people do have acne, and every once in a while they do think that it doesn't look so nice, and they want to pop a pimple, and it happens to be Shabbos, and the Gemara discusses, am I allowed to do that? When I do that, pus is going to come out, or sometimes blood is going to come out. Is that something that is permissible on Shabbos? Again, it's not relevant only to the discussion that we're having here. It's something that's relevant to other things as well. Sometimes a clinic will have to take an ultrasound. So I'm going into a clinic. There's no malacha involved in me going into a clinic, as long as I'm not going through automatic doors, but then they're going to do an ultrasound on me. Is that something that's permissible? Think about in Israel. When you have Jewish technicians who have to do the ultrasound, are they allowed to do it on Shabbos? Well, what are you doing an ultrasound for? If I'm doing it for a woman who comes in who's pregnant, and we have to make sure that the baby, that the child, that the embryo is healthy, obviously you're allowed to do an ultrasound. But what if you're doing an ultrasound because you're trying to get that woman pregnant, and you need to see what's going on inside? Is that permissible? Is that, there's no chola here, you're not sick. Is that something that we would allow? Is that something that perhaps is out of bounds? If you do an egg retrieval, there's so much malacha involved in doing an egg retrieval. That's not a simple procedure. You have to turn on all kinds of machines. Am I allowed to ask a non-Jew to do it? Is the non-Jew allowed to be asked to do it? Is a Jew allowed to do that on Shabbos? And there are so many questions. Imagine an IVF or an embryo implantation. Sometimes you have to do a sperm harvesting or a sperm aspiration or take someone's temperature because you have to know what the body's regulation is up to at that point. All of these questions, and again, a thousand more, are something that are really not discussed often, but are asked all the time. And it's something, as I mentioned, 6.5 million people in America are dealing with this. And it's something that I can assure you, if 10% of the childbearing women in the United States are struggling with infertility, it means that 10% of our community is also struggling with infertility, which is not a small number. That means that 1 out of 10 women that you know of childbearing age are going to have some kind of hardship and some kind of difficulty. And it really is upon us to appreciate and understand some of the struggle and some of the challenge, as we mentioned. But I thought this was an opportunity to talk about the halachic aspect. Now, what's interesting about this general topic is that when we speak about a chola in general and the relationship that a chola has to various mitzvos, the threshold is not always going to be the same. What I mean by that is as follows. For example, the Rishonim say, we have 613 mitzvahs in the Torah, and the expectation is that even if somebody's sick, they have an obligation to observe it. So say, for example, I would have, Rachmana Litzlan, I would have diabetes. That does not then say that I don't have an obligation to sit in the sukkah or to shake the lulav. It doesn't mean that I'm not going to have to put on tefillin or daven shacharis in the morning or keep Shabbos. The expectation is that a chola, even though, yes, it's at times uncomfortable for them, and they have things that they need to take care of, it does not make them exempt from observing mitzvahs. The Rambam even says when it comes to the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, so we all have an obligation to learn Torah every day, v'hagisa bo yomam v'layla, and the Rambam says, who is involved in that obligation? What if I don't feel well? So do I still have an obligation? The Rambam says very clearly in Hilchos Talmud Torah, Perek Aleph, the very first chapter, he says, kol ishmi Yisrael chai b'talmud Torah. Every Jew is obligated to learn Torah, bein shalim begufo, bein bal yisurim, whether I was born with no problem, with no issue, whether I have a disability or I don't, I have an obligation to learn Torah. Now again, somebody who has a disability is not going to be able to learn as much Torah as somebody else. They're struggling. It's hard for them. If they have a learning disability, of course they're not going to be able to learn as much Torah. They're not going to accomplish as much. But everybody shares the basic obligation. You don't have an exemption just because you might be sick. We do find a very small number of examples where the Gemara does say specifically that because somebody is a chola, because somebody is not well, they would be exempt from a particular mitzvah. So for example, the Gemara says in Masechah Sukkah that a chola is pater from sitting in the sukkah. Somebody who's sick doesn't have to sit in the sukkah. What does that mean? What kind of sick person does not have to sit in the sukkah? Who are we referring to? What kind of illness do they need to have? So obviously, somebody who's in the ICU in the hospital, we're not going to take them out and say, oh, it's sukkah, so you have to sit outside in the sukkah this week. Of course not. That's not what we're talking about. But how far does this go? I have a headache, so I don't sit in the sukkah? How far do we take it? So that's a very interesting question. When it comes to sukkahs, so the Gemara tells us that the pasuk, when it introduces the whole mitzvah of sukkah, it says, Basukos teshvu shivas yamim. You have to sit in the sukkah for 7 days. And we have a drasha. Chazal tell us, teshvu ke'ein taduru, which means you should live in your sukkah the same way you would live in your house. If I would have a house that has a leak in the ceiling in one of the rooms, I wouldn't sleep in that room. If it was leaking onto my bed, I wouldn't sleep there. I would find another room. I would get somebody to come fix it. Well, the same goes in the sukkah. Why would I sit in the sukkah if it's raining outside, if it's leaking into the sukkah, if it's not comfortable for me? That's not ke'ein tadur. That's not the normal way that I would live in any other house in my life. So why would I live that way in my sukkah? And that's why the threshold when it comes to the exemption for the mitzvah of sukkah is very low. It's anything that I wouldn't do in my other house where I live the other 365 days of the year, I'm not obligated to do in the sukkah. And therefore the Gemara tells us, the lashon of the Gemara is, we're not talking about a cholo sheyesh basakana. As we said, we're not talking about somebody who's in the ICU, who's on very serious machinery. Obviously, they don't have to observe the mitzvah of sukkah. What we're talking about is afilu chash be'enav, afilu chash be'rosho. Somebody has a headache. So you wake up with a headache, you say, you know, I'm not comfortable sitting outside in the sukkah. You don't have an obligation to do so. Well, what do you mean? We get headaches all the time. But the answer is, if I had a headache, I would take off a couple of hours from work, or I would take a few minutes for myself and lay down. So therefore, we assume that that would be an exemption, which is a very surprising halacha that we find in the Radvaz. The Radvaz writes in one of his tshuvas that he thinks we have the right to broaden this, to extend it. And he says, let's say somebody has a headache. So he says, I believe they wouldn't have an obligation to do the mitzvah of Shnayim Mikra Ve'echa Targum. So it happens to be, there's a mitzvah for all of us to go through the Parsha every week, Shnayim Mikra Ve'echa Targum. There's so much to learn from the Parsha. There's so much to gain from the messages, the timeless messages of Chumash, and the weekly Parsha give us so much to think about. So we have a mitzvah of doing Shnayim Mikra Ve'echa Targum every week to go through the Parsha with Rashi or with one of the other commentaries. And it's something that will enrich and enhance our lives if we do it studiously, if we do it carefully and we continue to do it year after year. It doesn't get boring, it gets more exciting as you go. So this is something that the Radvaz says. What if somebody has a headache one week and they're just not feeling up to it? So the Radvaz says, well, the same way by sukkah, you don't have to sit in the sukkah if you're not feeling well, so too you don't have to do Shnayim Mikra. And that is very surprising, because the only reason why by sukkah you don't have to sit there is because the Torah says Teshvu Ke'en Taduru. The only obligation I have to sit in the sukkah is when it's something that is similar to the experience of living in my own house. So if it's raining in my house, I would move out and move somewhere else. If it's raining in the sukkah, I move out and go somewhere else. So that is why this is a very interesting halacha. The Gemara tells us in Maseches Chagiga, we have a mitzvah of shalosh pa'amim bashana, yera'eh kol zechurcha espanei adon Hashem. We have a mitzvah of aliyah l'regel three times a year. So who's supposed to do the mitzvah of aliyah l'regel? Everybody? What if I'm not feeling well? So do I have to go? So how much do I have to not be feeling well to not go? So the Gemara says, it says, you have to go three times a year. It's called Aliyah L'Regel, means I have to walk with my feet. So what if I don't have feet that are working properly? What if I am paralyzed? What if I'm crippled? What if I'm incapacitated for some reason? I use crutches. I need some kind of support. I need a prosthetic. I have a cane. I go in a wheelchair all the time. So the Gemara says, in such a case, I would have no obligation of Aliyah L'Regel, because the mitzvah is to be able to use my feet to go to the Beis HaMikdash, to go to Yerushalayim, and I can't do that. So therefore, that would be something that would exempt me from that mitzvah of Aliyah L'Regel. In fact, the Talmud Yerushalmi writes that it's not limited to somebody who can't use their feet. After all, the Torah says, "V'samachta b'chagecha." When you go up to the Beis HaMikdash on these three occasions during the year, you have to feel a sense of simcha. So what if I'm totally depressed? What if I am, for some reason, in a very bad state of hurt right now? And I don't feel that I could be b'simcha, the Yerushalmi says, then you are exempt from the mitzvah of Aliyah L'Regel. So it's interesting. You go to different mitzvahs and you find that the definition of what we would say exempts a person from the mitzvah that they're supposed to do could be very different. For example, the Gemara tells us that a man has an obligation to wear tefillin. What if a man is not feeling well? He still has to wear tefillin. But what kind of not feeling well? So the Gemara tells us that somebody who has a chole me'ayim, someone who has a stomach ache, is not supposed to wear tefillin, because tefillin require a gufnaki. If you're going to be running out to use the restroom back and forth, in and out the whole davening, then it doesn't make sense to put on your tefillin. That wouldn't be something that is appropriate. So again, it's very different definitions that we find with regard to different mitzvos and the exemption from those mitzvos. Why is this relevant? It's relevant because you have to ask yourself, what is the definition of a chole when it comes to the laws of Shabbos? We all share an obligation to observe Shabbos. We all share the obligation not to violate the laws of Shabbos. But at some point, we would all agree that somebody is allowed to be mechal Shabbos. So what is that point? At what point would we assume that you're allowed to violate? And to what extent do I have a right to violate? So this is a very interesting sugya. The Gemara in Maseches Yuma discusses, minayin lepikuach nefesh shadocha es haShabbos. How do I know that saving a life overrides Shabbos? Which is an interesting question. We don't find that the Gemara asks that about anything else. Right? The Gemara does not ask us, how do you know that if my life depends on it, and I don't have any food and I'm going to starve to death, how do you know that you're allowed to eat non-kosher food? The Gemara doesn't ask that question. The Gemara doesn't ask this about anything else. So this is very curious. Why does the Gemara ask it here? There's an assumption that we violate Shabbos for the sake of saving a life. And the Gemara says, how do you know that? Where does that come from? Who told you? The Gemara gets into a whole discussion about it. The conclusion is that the Pasuk says that we have an obligation to do mitzvahs, and the end of the obligation, the Torah says, v'chai bahem. From the fact that the Torah says, v'chai bahem, means we should live through the experience of doing mitzvahs. V'lo sheyamas bahem. The expectation is not that I'm going to give up my life for the mitzvahs of the Torah. To be a martyr is not something that is the ultimate be-all and end-all Jewish experience. It's not what we want from ourselves. Unfortunately, sometimes a person dies al Kiddush Hashem, and that is tragic, and it's terribly unfortunate. But that's not the way we see the perfect life of a Jew being played out. Perfect life of a Jew is they will live, they'll be healthy, and they'll have the opportunity to observe mitzvahs throughout the healthy life that they live. And if at some point during their life there's a conflict between life itself and observing a mitzvah, the mitzvah takes a backseat and life takes precedence. That's what the Gemara comes to the conclusion. So when a person is faced with that dilemma and somebody's life is in jeopardy on Shabbos, somebody's life is in danger, you have to be mechalel Shabbos in order to save that life. So much so that the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Shin Chaf Ches in Hilchos Shabbos writes that not only do we assume that there's an allowance for me to be mechalel Shabbos, but this is actually encouraged. This is something that is enthusiastically encouraged. That if somebody's life is in danger on Shabbos, not only are you allowed to be mechalel Shabbos, but you absolutely must be mechalel Shabbos, and you cannot hesitate. In fact, when the Rambam writes the halacha, he says that it should be done al yidei the gedolim shebayir. You don't look for a young child. You don't look for a nobody to go be mechalel Shabbos. You take the leaders of the community, and if there's an emergency, you make them go out. I never appreciated the words of the Rambam until a couple of summers ago. There was a serious emergency in Camp Simcha in the summer when I was there. A kid went missing, couldn't find her, didn't know what was going on. The girl wasn't from. And I said, it's Shabbos. So even though it's Shabbos, she has her phone. She's not religious. She's from Israel. And I said, call her on the phone, find out where she is. It's dangerous. You can't just, the kid was missing and we didn't know where she was. So the counselor was just like, frozen. What do you mean call her? It's Shabbos. I said, but her life is potentially in danger. So she wouldn't do it. I mean, not in defiance. She just had never been mechalel Shabbos in her life and didn't really know what to do. I said, give me your phone. So I walk with her to the bunk. I don't go into the bunk houses because it's a girl session. So I said, I'll wait outside. I waited outside. She gave me her phone. I turned it on. I called the girl. And this counselor is looking at me like, it's Shabbos. I can't believe it. And I'm having a whole conversation with the girl. Turns out the girl said to me that she left the campus. I said, left the campus? How'd you leave the campus? There's a guard in the front. There are gates all around. How'd you get out of here? So I said to her, can you send me, I didn't want to make her nervous. So I said, can you send me, the night before actually the girl came to talk to me, how the food's terrible and she's so angry. And I said to myself, it doesn't make sense. Camp Simcha has the greatest camp food ever imaginable. What do you get at home? I asked her, what do they feed you at home? Do you live in a palace? Do you have maids working for you and cooking for you all day? She said, no. So I said, what did you expect when you came here? I don't understand. More than this? Anyway, so we had a conversation about it. She told me she's totally depressed. She was really upset. She was going through a very hard time. And I said to her, look, if need be, we'll get you some food that you like. She basically meant to say that I eat treif at home. And here, the food's awful because it's all kosher. I didn't understand that when I was talking to her. So on Shabbos afternoon, when I called her when she was missing, I said, okay, I'll meet you at the non-kosher restaurant. Just tell me where you are. You know, where'd you go? So I told her, send me a WhatsApp location. So anyway, we're back and forth. I said, send me pictures of where you are. I'm curious. I'm interested. Like, you know, what'd you go to look at? It was an interesting story. In the end, we had to jump in the car. And I saw that people were hesitating. I said, you got to get in the car. So I got in the front seat of the car. And it was only after I got in the car that they filled up the car with the therapists who came along, and these and those, and the counselors and the division heads and everyone who had to go. But it was a learning experience for me because I had learned this Rambam 100 times, where the Rambam says, when Chilul Shabbos is necessary, it has to be done al yidei ha-gedolim. Gedolim doesn't mean you hold yourself to be the greatest person. Gedolim means you are the responsible adult in the room. And if that's you, don't pawn it off to other people and say, No, you should go, you should do this. No, you have to be the one to take initiative, because they will follow if you show them how it's supposed to be done. And I didn't appreciate those words of the Rambam until it actually happened, when I saw that people hesitate, people are afraid, and people are not quick enough to do what needs to be done if the times call for it. So, in fact, the Ramban, one of the Gedolei HaRishonim, writes in Maseches Sanhedrin, what if a patient decides, you know what, I want to be a righteous person, I want to be a pious Jew, and even though I have an emergency, I'm not going to go to the hospital on Shabbos, I'm going to wait till after Shabbos, and we'll see what happens. You know, if I die on Shabbos as a result, it's fine. We once actually had a, I'll tell you in a second, it's an interesting story, I'm sorry, I'm getting totally sidetracked, it happens. So the Ramban, when he talks about this, this is a topic that I love talking about, for anyone who's heard me speak, I enjoy this a lot. So the Ramban writes that a person who has that kind of perspective, Hareze chasidus shel shtus, the Ramban says. That's not piety. That's a person being reckless, irresponsible, silly. If you thought that was bad, the Ramban continues the statement and says, Vidino kishofech damim. It's as if he is responsible for murder. Because you never know. Seconds count. And sometimes these things, if they're not addressed immediately, really, really matter. And it can negatively impact a person to the point that they might lose their life. And therefore the Ramban says, you don't have the right to make that choice. You don't have the right to say, I want to be so religious and so devout and so spiritual that I'm not going to violate Shabbos, and I absolutely refuse to get in the Hatzalah car, and I don't want to go to the hospital. You don't have a right to make that choice. You have to be Mechal Shabbos if this is what the times call for. So the same goes not only when it comes to Shabbos, the same is by Yom Kippur. Even though Yom Kippur is one of the most serious days of the year, if somebody's a chola and their life is in danger, they have to eat on Yom Kippur. There are no two ways about it. That's what needs to be done, and there's nothing to feel bad about. That's what's supposed to be done. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from you. It's okay. So, you know, every year I have to leave davening in the middle on Yom Kippur. At some point, somebody comes in and says, you know, I have an elderly parent, I have somebody in the family who just refuses to eat, but they're really not well. And I, you know, you always try to encourage them. Okay, you got to talk to them. I mean, obviously you need a doctor to tell them what to do, but it's for religious reasons that the person doesn't feel comfortable eating. And I think this year or last year, I forgot when it was, I told the person, and it happens almost every year, that I have to walk to somebody's house in the middle of davening and actually sit down with the individual and say to them, look, I understand that it's Yom Kippur, and I appreciate that, but it's really not what God wants from you. And the response that I got was, I'm a Holocaust survivor. Don't tell me what to do. I kept Shabbos and Yom Kippur in the Shoah, and I'll do what I want. Now, of course, I shut my mouth, as I should have. But, as beautiful as that is, it's 1,000% wrong. I appreciate the fact that you survived the Shoah, and you sacrificed your life, and that you're an amazing Jew. And I have the greatest respect, and I always will. But it's wrong. Right now, you're not feeling well. The doctors told you you need to eat on Yom Kippur because you're over 95 and not well. So then that's what you need to do. So there was an amusing story a couple of years ago in Shaarei Tzedek Hospital where there was somebody who was not well. He was in the ICU. He was really at the end of his life. And the doctor said that he absolutely could not fast on Yom Kippur. But he had dementia, and he was a little disoriented. And the children used to take turns going to visit. Every day somebody else came to help take care of their father in the hospital. Obviously the hospital was taken care of, but they always had a family member there. So they made up amongst themselves that they were not going to tell him that today was Yom Kippur, and they took the calendar out of the room to make sure that he wouldn't realize. And the children made up amongst themselves that whoever's day it is to go visit on Yom Kippur should not wear a suit. You should come in weekday clothing. This way he won't be led on to the fact that today is different than any other day. So that's what he did. He came in his polo shirt on Yom Kippur and his khaki pants, and he comes to visit his father. And he says to the father, Nu, did you eat today? The father says, no, it's Yom Kippur. What do you mean, did I eat today? Son says to him, what are you talking about? You think I would dress like this on Yom Kippur? Look how I'm dressed. I don't dress like, I'm a frum guy. I go to shul on Yom Kippur. I wouldn't be here. And the father says, what are you talking about? Don't try to fool me. I'm not as foolish as you think. I'm well enough to know that today is Yom Kippur. I will not eat. And the son says, no, really, you're making a mistake. You're confusing it. Yom Kippur already was. It was last week. You're not remembering. Back and forth. He realizes he's not getting anywhere. He goes and gets his father a sandwich. The father says, I will not eat it. I don't care what you say. And the son says, it's not Yom Kippur, I'm telling you. The father says, yeah, wise guy, you take a bite. So the Shaila then became, Does he have a right to eat a sandwich on Yom Kippur in order to convince his father, who needs to eat on Yom Kippur, that this is the right thing to do? That's an amazing shaila. So the same way that the Hatzalah member has a shaila, am I allowed to go on the call on Shabbos? Am I allowed to do something to be Mechal Shabbos to save someone's life? This person had the shaila, do I have a right to eat a sandwich on Yom Kippur in order to save somebody's life who won't eat it without me? It's an amazing shaila. It's a beautiful shaila, but a fascinating one. Again, you can say a million and one examples, but it's clear. What's clear is that when somebody's life is in danger on Shabbos, we have to be Mechal Shabbos. And it's not something that we have a right to hesitate about. It's something that we need to do, and it's something we should not feel uncomfortable about. So much so, the Mishnah Berurah quotes in the name of the Talmud Yerushalmi, that somebody who takes the time on Shabbos when there's an emergency and runs to the rabbi's house to ask a shaila, oh, are we allowed to do this or that? The Mishnah Berurah writes in the name of the Yerushalmi, Hareza Shofech Damim, because maybe in the interim, while you ran to go ask the question, something negative happened and it moved along and got worse. And not only that, the Mishnah Berurah says, Hanishal, the rabbi who got the shaila, Hareza Maguna, shame on the rabbi. So my father always said, why is it shame on the rabbi? What did I do wrong? Someone in my community was silly enough to run to my house instead of running to the hospital? Why is it my problem? So my father said, it means you're not a good rabbi. If you didn't educate your people to know that on Shabbos, the most important thing is someone's life, if they don't know that, it means you're doing a bad job. It means you're doing a bad job. That's what it means. Hanishal hareza maguna, shame on the rabbi. Yes, because that's his job. He should let people know what the values of the community are. So yes, it's true, we value Shabbos and we value Yom Tov and we value Yom Kippur, but we value life more. And if your community doesn't understand that, that life is the most valuable thing that we have, and that it trumps everything else, then it means you're doing a horrible job giving over the values that the community needs to know. So that, I think, is amazing. So much so, I remember a number of years ago that a rabbi came into my father when we were learning together, and he said, you know, somebody in my community came and he was Mechal Shabbos, he shouldn't have been, and whatever, there was an emergency, but it wasn't a real emergency, whatever, there were ways around it, but he shouldn't have done something. And the rabbi came in to ask my father that the person wanted to know what kind of tshuva they should do for a kapara, for the terrible thing that they did on Shabbos when they thought it was an emergency and it wasn't. And my father said, he doesn't need a tshuva, you need a tshuva, the rabbi. Because it means you didn't educate him. It means you did a poor job being a rabbi. And the fact that he didn't know the protocols, how to behave on Shabbos when an emergency comes up. I always say the story when I was in the hospital when we had our first child. So I spent Shabbos in the hospital with a young man who was learning in a kollel somewhere. And I went in the morning to Daven Shacharis, right near LIJ. There's a shul two blocks away. So it was wonderful. And we went. In case you ever have a child who goes there for Shabbos, they give you a very cute, they give you an aliyah Shabbos morning because they assume you're coming from the hospital. And they give you a onesie that says on it, I spent my first Shabbos in New Hyde Park. It's very sweet. So there I was. I went to shul. I came back. And I'm waiting outside of the maternity ward for a non-Jew to walk in to open the door. So there's a frum guy standing out there next to me. He was a guy learning in a local yeshiva here. And I'm looking at him. He's eating his Shabbos meal out there. So he says, what are you waiting for? I said, I'm waiting for somebody to come by to let me in. He says, no, your wife is sick. You should go inside. I said, yes, my wife had a baby, but she is being very well taken care of. Of course, I'm here to help out, but this is not an emergency. So he says, this is not the place to be machmir. So I told him that I'm quite aware of Hilchos Shabbos, and I know a little bit about this. I said, it's not appropriate to do this right now. So he says, you're going to be machmir, I'll do it for you. I said, it's very sweet of you, but the problem is that the Shulchan Aruch says, if a Jew does a malacha for you that they weren't allowed to do, I can't even derive benefit. So I said, now I'm stuck. Now you did the malacha, I can't even go through with the door. I have to wait anyway till somebody comes through again. We were having this conversation. I came back. I went to his Rosh Hashiva. I didn't say who it was. Happens to be our kids are in the same class now in yeshiva. And every year when we go to parent-teacher conferences or all the different get-togethers, I'm like, hey, remember that? So I went to his Rosh Hashiva and I said, I don't blame the guy for not knowing what to do. He was having his first child. He's never been in a hospital on Shabbos. How's he supposed to know what he's supposed to do? He doesn't know the laws. But I said, how could it be that you have a yeshiva where this guy's learning in a kollel and he has no idea how to observe Shabbos when it comes to a cholel? That's the problem. We need to have some kind of sensitivity training that people should understand. Yes, life is valuable, life is important. We need to be Mechal HaShabbos when necessary, but we're not allowed to be Mechal HaShabbos when it's not necessary. So this is something that obviously we all need to be well aware of. It's something we need to think about. At the same time that the Gemara tells us that we have to violate Shabbos when somebody's life is in danger, on the other extreme, the Gemara also says that there's a prohibition of tochein on Shabbos. You're not allowed to grind something on Shabbos. You're not allowed to crush something. And as a result of that, there's a gzeira midrabbanan that you're not allowed to take a pill on Shabbos. You're not allowed to take medication. Why is that? Because the Gemara says, back in the times of Chazal, they used to crush up different ingredients, pulverize them, and make them into a pill. So as a result of that, we're concerned, shema yishachek samamanim. Maybe, if we're going to allow somebody to take medication on Shabbos, they will end up grinding the material on their own, grinding up the ingredients and making their own pill, and they will violate a malacha on Shabbos. I see I'm getting a lot of stares right now. I'm sure many people are on all kinds of medications. We'll get to that in a second. But the strict letter of the law is, the Gemara says, that you're not allowed to take medications on Shabbos because shema yishachek samamanim. We're concerned maybe somebody is going to crush up the ingredients. Now, you'll say, nowadays, none of us are pharmacists. We don't know how to make medication. We don't know what ingredients to crush up to make a pill. So this shouldn't be relevant. Good point. But for some reason, we still observe this issur d'rabbanan that we're not allowed to take medication. So the Shulchan Aruch asks, who are we talking about? Who's not allowed to take medication? So somebody who had a valve replacement and now needs to have, I think there's all kinds of very important medication you need to take every day, aspirin, blood thinners, all kinds of things. What are you going to tell them? Shabbos, you can't take medication. Of course not. There's a concern that the blood's going to stop pumping. There's a concern the heart's going to stop working. You can't tell a person like that that they can't take medication. Obviously, if it's a chole, if it's somebody who's really sick and they need the medication, then you take the medication. There's no two ways about it. So that's clearly not what the Gemara is describing. So who are we talking about? Who is this talking about when it says you're not allowed to take medications? So the Beis Yosef introduces us that when it comes to the laws of Shabbos, we have different degrees of chole. We have different levels of sick people. So we have the highest, most extreme level is somebody who's a chole sheyesh basakana, somebody who's really gravely sick, and we're afraid they're going to lose their lives potentially. Not only lose their life potentially on Shabbos, but lose their life in the near future if we don't tend to them, if we don't take care of them in the appropriate way. That's the first degree. One step down from that is somebody who's referred to as a sakanas aver. Sakanas aver means they had some kind of injury to a part of their body, and if we don't help them, if we don't tend to it immediately, they're going to lose the ability to use that organ. So what would that be? Someone has a broken arm, right? If you don't, I don't know if that's so much of an emergency. I don't know, can that wait or not? They say if you don't wait for that, it can potentially cause a blood clot. I'm not in medicine enough to know, but that's what I've been told. So that's potentially life-threatening. But officially, it would be under the category of sakanas aver. So that's one step down. It's not going to lose their life, but you're going to lose the ability to use this limb for the rest of your life. You're going to have some kind of impairment as a result of not taking care of it. The third level is what we refer to as a chole she'en bo sakana. You have somebody who's sick, their life is not in danger, but they're not feeling well. How do you define a chole she'en bo sakana? So again, this is the three categories, we'll get to this in a minute, and the fourth is somebody who's a bari with mechush ba'alma. You have somebody who's feeling fine, but they have the sniffles. That's not called sick at all. You're nothing. You're fine. Right? I love it. A guy gets a headache, literally he's in bed for 3 days. A woman has a headache, it's like it's another day. Well, what do you think? I'm not going to go to the supermarket, and I'm not going to take care of the kids, and I'm not going to do... This is women, you know, they know how to be men. They know how to be strong. My father always says, the Gemara says, a woman has... my father always talks about this, how the Gemara says that a woman who just gives birth or a woman who's pregnant might have a certain status of chole. My father says, now with all the pills that they take, prenatal pills, postnatal pills, they're healthier than any man ever is. And they're getting checked out every week by the doctor and making sure that everything's fine. You're much healthier than any husband, for sure. So anyway, it's interesting to think about that. How far would we take the limits of a woman who is pregnant or a woman who has just given birth? Anyway, so a mechush ba'alma, somebody who's feeling fine but has the sniffles, somebody who's feeling fine has a slight headache, that is the person that the Gemara says is not allowed to take medication on Shabbos. Why? Because we have a concern, shema yishachek samamanim. But somebody else who's really not feeling well, so what does it mean to be a cholesh she'ein bo sakana? We spoke about someone who's cholesh she'yesh bo sakana means you got to drive to the hospital immediately, life's in danger. Sakanas aver is the step down, which means if we don't tend to this problem, they're going to lose the ability to use this organ going forward. That's a problem. So that's sakanas aver. It's an interesting tshuva in the Tzitz Eliezer. The Tzitz Eliezer was Rav Waldenberg. He was the Rav of Shari Tzedek Hospital for many, many years, and he wrote an amazing series of tshuva svarim called the Tzitz Eliezer. So he has many, many medical tshuvas in there because he was the rabbi in Shari Tzedek Hospital. So he has a shaila there, somebody who stutters and needs to do certain things on Shabbos because they always have to do certain things to help them take care of their stutter. So I don't know exactly what needed to be done, but it was some kind of malacha that needed to be done. And he was asked the question, would they be allowed to do whatever needed to be done on Shabbos as well? And he said, in my opinion, that is a sakanas aver. If I don't tend to the problem of stuttering, I will have a faulty speech for the rest of my life. I will have an impaired speech for the rest of my life. It doesn't mean that you are a deficient human being. Chalila, you're a wonderful person. But you yourself recognize that you want to speak like many others speak. And you don't want to be stuttering because people don't understand you. So he said, how could it be that we're not going to allow this person to do whatever needs to be done on Shabbos to take care of the stuttering if, after all, that should be a classic example of sakanas aver? If we don't give you an allowance to do it, you're going to be stuck with this impairment, with this fault, with this problem for the rest of your life. So of course we have to allow you to do that. That's sakana sefer. What's a chola she'ema sakana? Very important question. Chola she'ema sakana is hard to define. But basically the way that the Shulchan Aruch defines it is somebody who is mutal mishkav. Somebody who is bedridden as a result of them not feeling well. So the common example would be somebody has a migraine. Migraine is not a headache. A migraine is something that really puts a person in bed. You're really not feeling well. Somebody has the flu. That's a chola she'ema sakana. We're not afraid. Again, people unfortunately die every year from the flu, but that's not the norm. There are plenty of people before COVID who went to work with the flu, right? They still did. They shouldn't have, but they went anyway. Plenty of people came to shul with the flu, so now we would never do that anymore, now that we've become more enlightened. But that's not the norm. That wasn't always the norm that a person stayed home. But sometimes people get the flu and they're really not feeling well. You have a fever. You stay in bed. That's called a chola she'ema sakana. Your life is not in danger, but you're not functioning normally. What's interesting about it is, the Shulchan Aruch says, you know what would be an example of a chola she'ema sakana? If you have a young child who has some kind of need, a little three-year-old who's screaming and yelling that they want a bottle, and I don't have a bottle, and I don't have milk, and I have to go somewhere else to go get the milk from the supermarket, whatever it is, right? We ran out of milk in the house, so what am I supposed to do? Shulchan Aruch says that would be considered a case of chola she'ema sakana. Why is that chola she'ema sakana? Kid's not going to die if he doesn't have milk. Give him something else. So what you see from that is, my father always points out, what you see from that is that the definition of a chola she'ema sakana is not necessarily what you would have thought. It means somebody who's not functioning in their normal tafkid that they otherwise would. So you have a kid. If I don't get the kid that bottle, he's going to scream for the rest of Shabbos and not be the child that he normally is. He doesn't know how to put himself together. He doesn't understand, oh, I'll give you this instead of that. He doesn't get it. And as much as I try to explain it to him, I'll give you a supplement, I'll give you orange juice, I'll give you a seltzer, I'll give you soda. Doesn't it? Soda would work. But to say, I'll give you something else, it's not going to work. The kid is not going to function normally if they don't have what they need. That is a chola she'ema sakana. So you take, for example, somebody's on birth control pills, right? So you would say they're a chola? It's not a trick question. You're not a chola. You're not sick at all. There's nothing wrong. You're totally healthy. You just don't want to have children right now. So you're on birth control pills. Yeah, you try to skip a day of a birth control pill and see what happens. So how do you take a birth control pill on Shabbos? How are you allowed to do that? There's a gzeira of shchikas samamanim, like we mentioned. You're not allowed to take pills on Shabbos because we're concerned that maybe, hang on to the end of the sentence, don't pass out on me. There's a concern that maybe you're going to crush up the ingredients, so how am I allowed to take it on Shabbos? So some say the reason why is because the whole gzeira of taking pills on Shabbos was only said for somebody who's sick. We're concerned that somebody who's sick is going to make themselves a pill. Somebody who takes birth control pills is not sick at all, so the whole gzeira was never said for them. That's a fancy way to explain it. My father says it's much simpler. If a woman doesn't have a birth control pill that she takes every single day, she's not going to function normally. She's not going to be able to be herself. On a normal day, this is the routine, this is what I need to do, and if I don't do it, my day is not going to be the way it should be. Right? Somebody has some kind of medication that they need to take every single day. So Rav Moshe says, you're going to tell this person, let's say sometimes the doctor gives you a 10-day regimen, right? So you need to take it 10 days, and they always say, don't skip a day. You skip a day, the whole thing doesn't work. So what are you going to say? There's always going to be a Shabbos in the 10 days, so I can't take it? So Rav Moshe says, there are people who are on anxiety medications. So Rav Moshe says, you're going to tell that person that on Shabbos they're not allowed to take the medication, they have to take it every day. It's a regimen that they cannot skip. And if they skip it, what are you going to say? Their life is in danger? No, they're not going to have a nervous breakdown, but they're not going to be themselves. That's a chodesh eim sakana. I'm going to sit the whole Shabbos and be anxious and be uncomfortable and be depressed or whatever it is. In such a case, that's a chodesh eim sakana. My life is not in danger. I'm not going to be in bed all day, but I'm not functioning the normal way that I should. I'm not functioning up to my maximum capacity as I normally would on any other day when I took my medication. And therefore, that's why we allow that on Shabbos. So now, all of this brings us to the couple who is struggling with infertility. And again, as we mentioned, there are so many different shilas that they are confronted with. What would we allow them to do on Shabbos and what perhaps not is a very, very important question. Well, the first question you need to ask yourself is, what is their status? What league would you put them in? Would you say that a couple like this is considered a chola sheyesh bo sakana? Are their lives in danger? Well, sometimes you have a person who's so severely depressed over the fact that they don't have children, there is a potential concern that maybe they'll commit suicide. Now, that's very unusual. So that's usually not the situation that we're dealing with. It's not like, if I don't get this, I'm going to kill myself. Obviously, if that's the scenario, we would do everything that needs to be done. That's usually not the case. So how would you categorize, how would you classify such a couple? Would you say that they are totally healthy? Some argue that they're considered a couple that's totally healthy. It's like the person who needs to take birth control. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not sick. You're not sick at all. So why should we give any allowance to you on Shabbos if after all you're not sick? That's what some say. That's not the generally accepted opinion. We generally assume, the way my father has told it to me, and it's written this way in the Nishmas Avraham as well, that's Dr. Abraham, he says, in his opinion, this should be considered like a sakana saver. Your reproductive organs, male or female, are not working the way they should. Many other people are having no trouble. For some reason, this couple is having trouble. That means that's the same as a broken arm. That's the same as somebody who, if we don't tend to them for this limb, for this organ of their body that is problematic right now, they're not going to be able to have usage of it going forward. Shouldn't that be this case? Shouldn't that be the same as our case? You have somebody whose reproductive organs are not working the way they naturally should have. And we now have an intervention that we can give them to make it work properly. Happens to be at Shabbos. So wouldn't you consider that a sakana saver? Many assume that that's a sakana saver. And whatever you'd be allowed to do for somebody who's in that predicament, who's in that situation of a sakana saver, we'd be allowed to do for this couple as well. Others say, perhaps this couple is considered a chola she'ein bo sakana. Because after all, they're not able to function normally. And if you've ever spoken to a couple that's going through this, they are not functioning normally. And until they have the result that they want, they continue not to function normally. So therefore, there are many who argue that they should be considered a chola she'ein bo sakana because of the emotional distress. Imagine you're going to tell them, they've been waiting for this appointment forever. They've been waiting to get this treatment. And now you're going to say, oh, your body's up to it. Now is the appropriate time. The doctors say, now is the perfect day to do it. Oh, I'm sorry, it's Shabbos, you can't come. You have to wait another 2 years. You have to wait another 6 months. You have to wait another 3 months. How can you tell somebody to do such a thing? How can you say that? That will put the person in a state of being a chola she'ein bo sakana. You think I'm going to function normally when I get that kind of answer? Now again, this does not mean that any time I'm feeling discomfort about my feelings toward a mitzvah, that means I have a right to do whatever I want. That's not what it means. Don't get the mistaken impression. What it does mean is that we do have guidelines and we do have a very clear set of rules when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos. And the question then becomes, how do we fit each individual person into one of those categories? What kind of illness does a person have, and where do they classify or categorize themselves? That is why it's a very important question to think about, because the outcome of that question will be something that has very, very severe and extreme and relevant ramifications to real life situations that come up every week, every day, every Shabbos, and it's something that I just felt was appropriate for all of us to be just even simply aware of, just to be sensitive to the fact that there are people who are thinking about this and who need to be thinking about it. We should all be thinking a little bit about it as well, but it's an opportunity for all of us to just share in this experience that they have. Just a reminder to everybody.